and people started talking about Rhodiol. The Dragon's Blood range. Dragon's Blood is sap from a tree rather than something from a scene in Game of Thrones, followed, which created even more excitement for the brand and is still one of our top-selling ranges. A third pivotal moment for Rhodiol was the launch of a new makeup range in 2014. Rhodiol started as a skincare range, and over 16 years, we've grown our skincare business to over 30 products, tackling every possible skincare concern, from fine lines and wrinkles to dehydration, sunspots, dark circles, neck, lips, and lashes. How could I take the business to the next level? I saw a gap in the makeup market, and I had to go after it. Having been in the skincare business for 16 years, you would think that it would be an easy task. Call your factories and tell them what you want, and you'll have a new makeup range in no time. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that. The contract manufacturers that do skincare are very different to the ones that do makeup. And while the UK has a good selection of skincare fillers and labs, there aren't any good makeup manufacturers. So there I was, almost like starting from scratch, visiting trade shows and understanding the colour market. A lot of makeup ranges are created by makeup artists and are mostly suitable for use by other makeup artists, so they can be intimidating for the rest of us. Too many colours, textures, options. Every time I would sit for a makeover at MAC or Bobbi Brown, I would love the look and buy tons of stuff, but then I would go home and wouldn't know how to replicate it. My idea was to come up with formulas and textures that were sheer and light, even for the most heavy-handed customer, and to educate every single customer on how to replicate the look at home. I wanted a range that was easy to use and apply, and I wanted to be able to show every one of our customers how to achieve a flawless look with just a few products in just a few minutes. I was looking at the makeup of the hottest celebrities and models and loved the idea of sculpting and contouring as a trend and incorporated that into our range. I was really excited about the idea of a new Rhodiol makeup range. I felt like I was launching a new brand all over again. It took me 3 years from coming up with the idea to launching the range. I spent a lot of time trying to source the best formulas in France, Italy, and Switzerland, as well as developing our unique packaging. A lot of skincare brands that launch makeup fail as they treat it as an extension of skincare. My vision was to create a makeup brand that could sit by itself, have its own identity, and not depend on the existence of skincare. I spent a lot of time designing our packaging and created bespoke compacts with textures and beautiful shiny hardware. I worked with the best factories in Europe to create a stunning collection that would stand on its own. After 3 years in development, the Rhodiol Sculpting Makeup Range was ready in the early summer 2014. I emailed one of our big supporters over the years, Daniela Rinaldi at Harvey Nichols, and we met within a week so that I could present the new range. Very direct as always, Daniela said to me, "How can we pitch for this?" "Excuse me," I thought to myself, "what do you mean?" I couldn't believe it. It turned out that Daniela not only got the concept, but she also liked it so much that she wanted it exclusively in her store. I said, "Give us a week and our marketing team will put together a marketing plan so we can get the exclusive counter and sculpting bar in Harvey Nichols, Knightsbridge." I couldn't have been happier. We were given 2 months to design and fit the counter, which was to be in the middle of the store next to Yves Saint Laurent, Estee Lauder and Tom Ford. Oh my God, we were playing with the big boys. We would be taking over the space from the US spa line that looked really sad and always empty. Within a couple of months, and with no previous experience in setting up counters, we installed our first flagship counter and sculpting bar. I didn't have anyone in the business with experience in designing and project managing counters, and it wouldn't make sense to hire a specialist just for this one. So, as usual, I project managed this on my own, treating the design as if it were part of my own home. During the time of the design, I happened to be in New York and went into Barney's and Saks and took lots of pictures of the counters I liked and was emailing the designer constantly. I ended up holding the designer's hand and choosing all the elements of the scheme myself. We used a dark grey colour to make the counter less harsh than black, and the light fittings are similar to the Tom Dixon ones I have at home. I wanted to give the counter a warm and homely feel with stools that had the same grey chenille material and beige piping as my sofa at home. When we launched the counter, everyone at Harvey Nichols was very impressed, and they couldn't believe how we had transformed and maximized the space. I have a soft spot for this counter, and I love to visit and chat with my team, finding out about customer feedback and listening to suggestions while having my makeup done by our professional makeup artists. We use the space to host customer, press and blogger events, and it's truly our home. Needless to say, I'm very proud of it. A year later, our counter sales mean that we're regularly within the top 10 selling brands in Harvey Nichols, London. And at times, we're ahead of Chanel, Yves Saint Laurent and Tom Ford. It's a great feeling to have your idea trusted by a retailer, and then to prove to them that you can make it happen. The launch went so well that we rolled out to all the Harvey Nichols regional stores within a year. With every new project I took on with Rodial, I had to think out of the box and make up the lack of funds with creativity and by taking constant risks. Success is about the relentless pursuit of what you want, and hard work is an essential ingredient. Those who are just after a get-rich-quick scheme and are not willing to put in the hard work are likely to fail. You will need to work non-stop. Monday to Friday, 9 to 6, is just about dealing with the day-to-day operation of your business. All your creative work will need to be done before 9 and after 6 and during weekends. There won't be time for hobbies, and forget about extended holidays. You may not have time for a social life or to cultivate friendships outside work, and even if you do, the non-stop, no-sleep-till-Brooklyn side of your personality will be wondering, what can this person do to help my business? It's a choice that you'll have to make, and you need to be comfortable with these sacrifices. I may be exhausted after flying the red-eye from New York and landing at Heathrow at 7 a.m, but I go straight to the office as I need to connect with my team and check up on how they've been doing. Am I exhausted? Yes. Do I have a coffee and just get on with my day? Absolutely. I could make a case to myself that, hey, it's my business, I'm the boss, I'll take the rest of the day off. And as I am the boss, no one is going to argue. But if you want success, there's no time for that. I've been known to fly to Japan for 24 hours for a meeting, and then as soon as the meeting is over, I'm back in a cab to the airport and flying back to London. Why not stay in Japan for one day or even a week? Adjust to the time difference, take a day shopping, absorb some culture. I'll tell you why. Traveling is not a hobby. I need to be back to catch up with my team, attend meetings, and be back with my family. Family is important. I'm not a complete machine. Quite simply, if you really want to succeed, you never really switch off. It's not that you can't switch off. It's that you don't want to. If this is your passion, if this is what you want, you'll find yourself switched on all the time. It will be a natural extension of your love for your business. It won't even be a conscious decision. When I'm not in the office, whether I'm at home or traveling, or even if I find myself miraculously enjoying a free weekend and an email comes in for whatever reason needs a quick response, of course, I will respond back any day, any time. Same goes for important calls. Obviously, I restrict these to legitimate, can't-wait issues, but the fact remains that I'm never really turned off from my business. Now, you may have read a lot of articles about this kind of behavior in the press, people checking emails by the pool and heading for an early stress-related grave, etc. Well, yes, I'm sure that's a valid point, but I refer to my earlier comment that this is not a job. It's a passion. I'm not trying to impress the boss or win a promotion or worried that I'll be replaced by that young go-getter in accounts. This is my business, so to me, it's no pressure at all. I'm available because I want to be, because I care about my business. We're operating across several different time zones, from the US to Asia to Australia, so things do tend to happen 24/7, and a quick response often saves a lot of time in the long run. It doesn't mean that I'm up all night responding to emails. Sometimes things can wait, and some things I'm happy to leave to my team. After all, what's the point of having them if I can't delegate? But I'm generally available when I have to be. I'm yet to find a massively successful person who works 9 to 5 and switches off after work. Sometimes I may hit a wall and find myself worn down and mentally exhausted. Despite my tough talk, I'm only human and something has to give. All I need is a good night's sleep, a good workout in the morning, and I'm back to action with even more energy. You need to find your own release valve and know when to let off the pressure. This isn't a sign of weakness. I'm thinking back to the macho who's done the most all-nighters culture of my banking days here. It should be part of your plan. Recognize, or take the word of someone you trust, usually your partner or PA, when you're flagging and need to step back. Refresh and regroup. You need the energy and the self-discipline to go all night for sure, but also to manage your time and get the balance right. Having said that, your resistance to tiredness may be greater simply because, if you love it, it won't seem like work. So you'll find you can go on longer than you would in a job you despise, or even are just a bit meh about it. If you ask me to do a crossword puzzle, I might fill in a few squares, doodle in the margin for a bit, and get a bit excited that I know the answer to six down, but ultimately I will just get bored and give up. I hate crosswords. So it is in all things. You need to really love it, want it, and enjoy it. This is what will give you the self-discipline to achieve it. If you pursue something that you are passionate about, that passion will keep you going. Pick a career that you love so much that you won't even consider doing something else. Working hard isn't just about the amount of time and the sacrifices that you need to make. It's also about which areas outside your area of expertise you're willing to explore. As an entrepreneur, you pretty much need to have a rounded understanding of everything, from your product to sales and marketing, from operations to finance and legal. Yes, you can hire experts and consultants, but you should be able to move out of your comfort zone and your traditional expertise and at least get a basic grasp on these areas. You need to know what they're talking about in the meetings, and you'll be able to quiz them to make sure they're doing the very best for your business. Don't be in the dark about anything. Remember, you're the captain of this ship, and you need to be familiar with every rivet. When you start a business, you have no choice but to be hands-on. You're most likely cash-strapped, and you need to stretch yourself pretty thin to fill all those holes. You're the sales manager, the operations manager, the accountant, and the admin assistant all rolled into one. You may even answer the phone in a different voice and pretend to be your own PA. I certainly did. As you grow and the business becomes more stable, you hire your first employees, usually people who have complementary skills to yours. So, between all of you, you cover all bases. And there comes a time when your business has a lot more people and you have your managers, and you've taken a step back. So now you can sit back and relax and let everyone else do the job for you. You worked hard all these years. Surely it's time to let others do their share of the hard work. Not quite. As much as you trust the people around you, you need to be on top of things and occasionally dig a bit deeper in every department to find out what's going on. There are times that your people won't share something with you because A, they want to show that they're on top of things, B, they don't think it's important, or C, they think you don't care. From this digging and the accumulation of small bits of seemingly unimportant information, you sometimes strike gold. You may get an idea for a new product, find the solution to a problem, or understand where the roadblocks to the business lie. So how do you find this stuff out? How can you keep on top of all the little things when you're so consumed with your own job, taking the company places, driving the big vision, global domination, etc.? The way I do it, and I know a lot of businesses do the same, is by holding the Monday morning meeting. This is a regular permanent fixture in everybody's calendar where I get the heads of all departments to go through their past week and talk about their plans for the upcoming week. This is a meeting where I get them to do the talking. Everyone has a chance to have their say and offer solutions to any issues, and it gives everyone an understanding of where we are now and a platform from which to follow up. It's also an excellent way to get everyone connected with the other departments. Some people naturally communicate more, either because they're closely connected in the business model or their sections are next to each other in the office, or simply because they're friends. Obviously, though, there are those who, without this meeting, might never make meaningful contact. The business might be just fine if they carried on in their own worlds, but having the right hand know what the left hand is doing is, as you might expect, very beneficial. It's not just about keeping tabs on what's going on. Knowing what everyone else is up to gives the business a great sense of cohesion. We're all singing from the same hymn sheet and are in tune. The airing of all this information has another benefit. It gives your staff a sense of ownership. They feel part of the bigger vision. If they can see the whole picture instead of being limited to their little corner, they have an opportunity to be more creative, more visionary, and more engaged themselves. In addition to the formal Monday meetings, if it's quiet, I might take people out for a coffee or lunch and check up on them in a more informal setting, or just call them into my office for a 5-minute catch-up. I try to connect with all departments as often as I can, and when I have a trip, I try to organize things so I can still be in the office for the Monday morning meeting. If a week goes by without that meeting, I feel disconnected from the team. There will be times that you will have worked really hard, made the sacrifices, but still you're not getting the results that you want. Do you give up? With every challenge, every disappointment, think to yourself, why am I doing this? What is the big picture? What would success look like if I kept going? Have the big picture always in mind. I have to admit, there are times that I'm overwhelmed. A product launch isn't as successful as anticipated. Certain team members are driving me crazy with how high maintenance they are. Some buyers are irrational with their requests, and sometimes this all happens within a day. What keeps me going? I take a step back and I think about the big picture. Think about how I love the industry I'm in. Think about what success looks like. And also think of where I started. Sometimes I spend so much time on a project that when I finally step back, I have a tendency to think I've got nothing to show for all the hard work and effort. That's when I have to remind myself to look back where I started with the project, and I'm always pleasantly surprised with the progress. It's about perspective. Overnight success, secret number 4. Face your fears. Let's be honest. Fear is horrific and paralyzing. Fear when you're an entrepreneur is commonplace. Fear of failure, fear of success, and fear of the unknown. Will I have enough cash to pay my staff? Will I grow fast? Will I be better than my competition? Will the deals fall through? Will the clients be unhappy? Will the suppliers fall through? Will someone sue us? Fear can come at you at any time. It's how the brain processes fear that can take it out of proportion. Fear holds so many people back in life. Fear of the unknown. Fear of not being good enough. Fear of failing. I went through them all. It's so much easier to avoid fear and keep on doing what makes you feel comfortable. Fear comes from a negative experience that you may have had in the past, and you think that if you experience the same situation again, you'll get the same negative feeling. It becomes a barrier to realizing your goals. In order to face your fears, you need to remove those barriers and push past the fear. It's crucial to surround yourself with people who believe in your abilities and help you in your journey of facing your fears. You can't face your fears in one go. It's a process. It's overcoming little by little and feeling slightly more confident every time. And when you look back at when you started, you'll realize the huge progress that you made. These are my top 10 tips for facing your fears. 1. Identify your fear. 2. Imagine the worst case scenario if your fear comes true. 3. Write down all the implications. 4. Read the implications one by one and think, would it be the end of the world if X happened? 5. Put a date in your diary of the day that you will take the first step to face your fear. 6. Make sure it's a day and a time when you can focus 100% on this task and there are no other pressing issues to take care of. 7. Mondays and early in the day are good options when our power of goodwill is the strongest. 8. Tell a good friend or a family member about it and ask them to be there to support you. 9. Go through further steps to address this fear. 10. Congratulate yourself with every step you take and record your progress. Chapter 5. Hiring smarter people than me. I have never been happier with my team at Rodial. I have a team of hard-working, passionate, and talented people working for me. Some of them have been with the business for more than 10 years. Anytime there's a job ad, we get hundreds of applications to fill the position. There's so much talent out there, and I can now pick the best of the best. It wasn't always like that, though. Since I started the business, I've hired and fired many times. Over the years, I have seen it all. Rodial is not a traditional 9-to-5 company. Everyone here works really hard, and while we do not encourage anyone to stay in the office late, there are from time to time a few people who might stay late, wrapping up presentations, finishing designs, or doing research. And there are a lot of others who arrive well before 9 to start going through their work with a clear head before everyone else arrives. Everyone is ready to roll up their sleeves and get any kind of work done if it's needed. When a company grows at the rate that we have, there are always a few holes, and I expect all my team to get these covered. I remember a time a few years ago when we suddenly got a huge wave of press on snake serum. It was great, but it was also unexpected. And as a consequence, it was insane. We suddenly had hundreds of thousands of people going onto our site to check out this miraculous product and buy it. We'd never had this amount of traffic in the past, and our website at the time wasn't designed to cope with it. We'd gone from a handful of visits a day to hundreds of thousands. The site crashed. We didn't have a customer services person in the team, let alone a customer services department. With the website down, the phones were ringing non-stop from customers wanting to purchase the serum, but couldn't get it online. We were losing sales here. This looked like our big leap forwards, and we were losing it. While the phones rang off the hook, I sat the whole office down and gave them a basic training in how to take an order on the phone. And suddenly, I had the biggest customer services team. Everyone, and I mean everyone, had to be ready and available to take orders, regardless of whether they were the managing director, the PR assistant, or the office cat. Everyone was going to have to help out to get us through until we had the site up and running again. It was one of the best days we had as a team that year. Everyone was happy to help. Everyone was buzzing on the Action Station's atmosphere, and the whole office was excited to be part of this challenge. I knew then I had a great team. When I hear people saying, "This is not my job," that's a red flag for me. Is this person right for the business? It's not all sunshine and lollipops, though. As an entrepreneur, you sometimes need to make a tough decision. There is one I shall never forget. We'd been growing for a couple of years, and even though we were still small, we were holding our own, and I was building a loyal team around me. But these are the times when businesses can be at their most vulnerable. I had gone from doing near enough everything myself to paying staff wages and office rent and upfront production costs. It was a big leap, and looking at the figures one night, I realized we had stretched too far. No matter how I juggled it, the cash flow just would not work. Money was tight, and I had to let some staff go. These were people who'd stayed late, who'd worked hard to keep us going, but if the business was to survive, I had to bite the bullet and tell them to go. It was bad enough having to tell two of my team there was no longer a job for them. What made it worse was that this was only a couple of weeks before Christmas. Yes, I was the Grinch. I absolutely hated myself, but things had got so tight with cash, I'm sure that the business would not have survived. As a startup, you will not attract the resources that you need for many reasons. A lot of great employees may be put off because they need to be in a stable company, and a startup presents uncertainty in terms of both job security and job description. When you start a new business, you need people who are street smart, who have the same vision as you. Since you will be tight with cash, you need them to think out of the box and come up with ideas to get things done that don't cost a lot. When you start, you will also need people who are flexible. In a small business, the roles are not very well defined. When I started, I had an accountant who, as well as doing the books, was also in charge of production, legal and office management, and an office assistant who would also assist on PR, social media and the web. Why would these people want to work for you when there are so many stable jobs out there? Because they believe in our brand, and you give them the opportunity to work in a startup, get the energy and the satisfaction of seeing a baby brand grow. They take part in the excitement without taking a massive risk, although they may not have the long-term job security an established company might offer. It also gives them the opportunity to learn different parts of the business, expand their skill set, and also work closely with you, the founder. They buy into your passion and drive, and this can be very addictive. How do you go about hiring people when you first start? I didn't have a budget to hire a recruitment agency. And still to this day, I would much rather get a candidate through other avenues rather than having to pay a hefty 15% fee on someone's yearly salary. When I started, we didn't have social media and our main recruiting platform was Gumtree. We would advertise for a job for £25 and get hundreds of CVs, which is great. But then how do you choose? A lot of applications will be an immediate no based on what they say on the covering letter. I would then narrow it down to the top five and invite them for an interview. Historically, 20% don't show up. As Woody Allen said, turning up is 90% of getting the job. When you're down to the top three, it's about how you connect with them at the interview. It's all about personal relationships and how they would fit with the team. I made a lot of mistakes hiring the wrong people over the years. Once the skills are there, and you hope no one lies on the CV, there are a few questions that I always ask. More often than not, you're faced with candidates who, on paper at least, all seem ideally suited. So you end up looking for reasons not to hire someone rather than to hire. If at the end of the interview there are no reasons not to hire, then you're onto something. I tried to see people at least twice. Sometimes the candidate will put on a great show at the first interview and are more relaxed on the second when they think they almost have the job and you get to really see where they are. What I like to do now is to get a few more people from my team to attend the interview, even if they wouldn't necessarily work with this person. We have a very strong culture and I like to see what my team's perception is of this new candidate. My motto is hire slow and fire fast. Take your time to hire. It's an important decision. I used to hire people in a rush because there was a job opening and then regretted it as it was the wrong choice. I now never rush a hiring decision, even if that means that a position may remain open for a few months until we get the right candidate. Overnight success, secret number five, interviewing tips. Your team can make or break your business. I spend most of my time recruiting, coaching and motivating my team as it's the most important element of the company. First things first, take time to find the right candidates and don't rush any decisions. Over the years, I've interviewed hundreds of people for all areas of the business and I've come up with some no-nos that help me quickly identify the best. My checklist for red flags when interviewing a candidate. 1. Has the candidate had long stretches of time being with one company? You don't want the ones who jump from one job to another every few months, as they may do the same with you. 2. Are there large, unexplained gaps in someone's CV? There are, of course, cases when a candidate needs to take some time off from the work they don't enjoy in order to make plans for their next career move and, as you know, I'm all for that. However, there are people who are just not meant to work at a full-time committed job and crack under pressure. A large number of unexplained gaps may indicate to me a lack of work ethic, and when things get tough, they give up. 3. Is the covering letter specific to your company and the position? You want to choose someone really interested in the brand and the job, rather than suspecting that this is the same application they've fired off for 100 positions. 4. What is the tone of the covering letter? A number of candidates say, I'd like to get this job to get experience to help me with my future career. You want to hear what they will bring to the table rather than what they want to get from you. 5. How far from the office do they live? We lost some great people having spent a lot of time training them and integrating them into the team, only to lose them shortly afterwards as the commute was too long. 6. How do they talk about previous jobs? I've sat through several interviews where the candidate has badmouthed their previous employers in excruciating detail. If they do this for the previous employer, you could be next. 7. Do their answers to your questions seem like they came from a textbook? You want to see who they really are, and they may be trying to hide something. 8. Ask them what other jobs they're applying for. I prefer to hear that it's not that many and that your position is their priority, would be their dream come true, etc., rather than you're just one of 10 possibilities and they'll take whatever they're offered. It's slightly different if they're all jobs in your specific industry. At least you know they're passionate about the topic. But you'd still like them to be excited by your brand. Avoid candidates with too many complicated personal problems. Not that you'd ask them during the interview, but there are candidates who explain in detail their complicated personal situation. It shows me that they have a lot going on with their lives and makes me question whether they will be focused on work. 10. Ask yourself, if I was on a plane with this person for 7 hours, would I enjoy spending time with them? As this may happen, you need to make sure you get along. Chapter 6. Risks that paid off. The road to success is not a straight line. You need to take some risks and you need to take some tough decisions. You can manage your risks by starting with something small, and once you get more confidence, take the next risk and so on, building your risk tolerance and going bigger and better each time. It doesn't always mean taking all your savings and investing them in that crazy idea. Sometimes it does, but it could be taking the risk to change industries, start a new job, or leave your job and start a small business from your spare room like I did. What you can see from my story is that all I did was take risks that led me to where I am today. I took a risk to leave my hometown and move to a big city to study. While studying, I took the risk to put myself out there and got a job in a magazine. When I realized I needed more business education, I took a risk to move to New York and study business. I then took a risk to work in a completely new industry, finance, and move to London. And after 3 years in that job, I took the risk of losing my high salary to start my own business. Do all risks pay off? Of course not, but all the risks you take build up your confidence, making it easier to take further risks. By 2010, Rodial had been running for 10 years. It became a household name in the luxury market. Over the years, we were getting a lot of requests from some of the more mass retailers who wanted to create an upscale apothecary feel within their beauty aisles. They had already taken some of the upscale brands on board, such as Philosophy and Bare Essentials, to create these niche areas within the stores. And now they were all asking for Rodial too, as it was such an innovative brand offering treatments targeted to specific skin concerns. No one else was offering anything remotely similar to it. At that time, the high street luxury brand collaboration was becoming very in vogue. Stella McCartney designed a range for Gap, Lanvin and Karl Lagerfeld collaborated with H&M, and Missoni collaborated with Target. It was all about creating a range that would share the DNA with the luxury brand in a more basic format. This way, the customer would get exposed to the luxury brand with the hope that they would later upgrade to it. And not to mention great PR as well as a new source of revenue for the luxury brand. Since I had a lot of demand for Rodial from mass stores that I couldn't sell to, I started thinking of creating a diffusion range that had some of the DNA of Rodial, but was more affordable and was distributed through a different network. The formulas would need to be effective, but instead of having 5 active ingredients used in their maximum concentration, we would focus on just one key ingredient that would do the job. I also recognized that this was a chance to target a slightly younger audience and focus on areas such as clogged and acne-prone skin, dehydration, and first signs of aging. I created a name that was inspired by the popular term for plastic surgery, nip and tuck, and the catch-all number one fashion word, fabulous, and called the range nip and fab. I had all the necessary internal resources by that time. Our design team put together the branding designs for Nip and Fab. We mocked up the range and presented it to the buyers, rather than commit to a full production, as I had to do with Rodial. We first presented to Boots in the UK, who loved the concept and wanted to launch in 600 stores, and Target in the US, who wanted to launch in 1,000 stores. It was really exciting to get such a positive reaction to a new brand, especially after all the challenges I had when I was starting with Rodial. It did help, of course, that I had 10 years of experience of running a very successful luxury skincare range and everyone knew about Rodial. It made my job so much easier. Even though Nip and Fab started as a spin-off of Rodial, it very quickly developed its own identity and target market with innovative product and a very distinctive tone of voice. Over the years, Nip and Fab has revolutionized the market with skincare innovations in a whole range based on glycolic acid to combat acne, signs of aging, and uneven skin tone. It became one of the best-selling skincare ranges in mass market stores and pharmacies worldwide. Nip and Fab also revolutionized the market by introducing a treatment product in a pad format throughout all our ingredient ranges. The Glycolic Fix Pads have become the best-selling pad product in all our retailers globally. Other ingredient ranges include Viper Venom, Dragon's Blood, and Kale. We also developed a specialized body range for products to target cellulite and other tongue-in-cheek names such as Bust Fix, Tummy Fix, and Upper Arm Fix. Our customers couldn't get enough. Launching another range was a risk. Launching a range that could cannibalize our main range was an even bigger risk. But we went with it, and Nip and Fab has grown over the years and has developed its own customer base very different to Rodial. The level of turnover will match that of Rodial in a few short years. It was a risk worth taking. There comes a point after you've been in business for a few years that you need to create buzz on another level. I needed to take the next risk and the next challenge to grow my brand awareness and sales. A very important part of growing a brand is keeping the interest of the public and the press. It's easy to capture the interest when you first start as the brand is new, exciting and has a different point of view. We worked very hard on the press during the first few years and it paid off. Press and in-store promotions were the main drivers of the sales. Yes, we did have some new products that got a bit of coverage, but nothing too exciting. Over the years, the press would ask me if I would consider bringing a face of the brand on board, and I always used to say no. The Nip and Fab business grew fast and globally. We were soon available in more than 15,000 stores worldwide. Our biggest market was the US, having just launched in 8,000 stores. My sales team were asking for some buzz in the US and we needed to come up with something big. Overnight success secret number 6. The importance of taking risks. Anyone can take risks even in their current job. Work extra hard. Offer to help outside your job description. But don't just put yourself out there. Make sure you learn some new skills. Don't be afraid to roll up your sleeves and show how committed and passionate you are about your job and your industry. Everywhere in life, people who succeed always take the extra step. I have seen this in my business, and the people who progressed from admin assistants to running departments always went out of the way to do more, to deliver more. Not only were they rewarded within this business, but they also learned skills that will help them to succeed in anything they chose to do with their lives and careers in the future. You will never know the outcome of anything unless you take a risk. When I sent that handwritten letter to 17 Magazine, telling them what I thought the magazine was missing and that I would be the one to fill the gaps and bring them a breath of fresh air, I was exposing myself to rejection. I could just have thought, they'll think I'm an idiot. They'll not even read my letter. I won't hear back for sure. Why take the risk? But I didn't. Or rather I did, but I ignored it. I had nothing to lose. When I decided not to continue with a career in finance and instead start my own business, I had no idea where this would lead me, and I did have quite a lot to lose. But if you don't do it, you'll never know. The passion to at least try outweighed the fear of risk. Whenever I'm about to take a risk of any sort, I always calculate what's the worst thing that can happen. If I'm able to live with the consequences of the worst-case scenario, I go for it. If you need to remortgage your house to start a business, I wouldn't take this lightly. It's a decision that takes a lot of thought. But if you hate your job or you hate your industry, but you're too comfortable where you are and you don't want to lose your high salary, do something about it now. Start researching the industry you want to get into. Read industry-related books and publications. Visit conferences. Work out the ways you can lose that salary but still be happy. It's an equation. You need to calculate the pros and cons and weigh it up for yourself. And if the maths works, then get updating your CV, get networking, and get yourself out there. I had to go from a six-figure salary and dressing in Prada suits and bags every day to no salary for 5 years and running a business hand to mouth. No Prada for me. I was shopping at flea markets and on the high street. But that was what I needed to do to grow my business. That was a small sacrifice to be able to support my business, and I was happy to dress on a budget when I had to. Don't be afraid of things going wrong. At the beginning, everything that can go wrong will go wrong. And at the beginning, when you start, you get more problems than you get victories. My first few years of running the business were all problems with people, products, cash flow, you name it. I went through it. And I always found a solution. In the early days, when we didn't have enough cash to pay the team and had to let people go, it was hard and heartbreaking, but the business needed to survive. I had to make those hard decisions, and it was a lot more difficult when we were only 4 people in the team. I still get problems of a different sort now, but having faced issues of will the business survive another day made me a lot more thick-skinned and able to take on problems in a calmer way. And once you're in your dream job or have started your dream company, keep taking risks. Take risks to create buzz and be visible. Take risks to create something that stands out against the competition. Find ideas that will create buzz, get people talking, and help your idea to go viral, even when you have very little budget. I could have gone safe and called my product anti-aging serum. Boring. I went all the way and called it snake serum. The name created lots of free press. It went viral internationally, and within a month of launching, we were shipping pallets of snake serum all over the world. The things we regret in life are the things we don't do rather than the things we do. Time to take a risk. Chapter 7. Create buzz. When I started the business, there were no funds for an office assistant, let alone for a PR agency. I was getting the Rodial name out there, but doing it on a shoestring. There were no Testino commissions or Vogue back cover ads for us, but it is possible to create buzz about your brand without a lot of money. You just need to think outside the box. When we needed our first Rodial promotional postcard, there was no way we could afford a commercial printer, and besides, they just laughed at the very idea of a print run of less than 10,000, so we just did everything at Vistaprint, using one of their template designs. Back then, we did everything on paper. Everything had to be printed out, artwork sent by post. Sometimes when I'm on social media and I think back to how it was when I started, it seems like another world. And I guess, in marketing terms, it was. When social media took off, it was like we'd suddenly discovered fire, or the wheel, or stretched denim. Nothing would ever be the same. The key to creating buzz around your product is to get press and influencers talking about your brand. If you're just starting out in a new industry and you don't know who is who, and you can afford to allocate some budget to a specialized PR agency, it's worth every penny. But do your research. Make sure they're worth the investment. There are a lot of half-assed PR agencies out there, and it can be hard to know who can do a good job and who is just going to take your money and then blame your product for not getting any press. Some are great in other fields but might be useless in your chosen industry. Some just might be useless. Ask for recommendations and get into a trial contract of 3 months to try things out and see how you get on. I've worked with a number of PR agencies over the years, large and small, and have seen everything. When I started, I went with a large and reputable agency to establish the brand and also be in the company of other reputable brands. It's important that you feel you're getting your money's worth, particularly if you don't have a lot of it and you do not want to be fobbed off. I found that when the larger PR companies are pitching for your business, you'll get the senior partners and creative directors come to see you. But then 6 months down the line, you find you're dealing with a junior account director and then the final ignominy. You only get email replies from the intern. With time, I decided to move to a smaller agency where our brands were the biggest and could get more attention. There are pros and cons to both. But just because you have a PR company working for you doesn't mean you let them get on with it. There is a clue in that last sentence. They are working for you. It can sometimes seem the other way around. It can be the same with model agencies and record companies. But remember, you can hire and fire them. They are your employee, sort of. So make sure they're pulling their weight and doing things in the right way for your brand. There were also times that I was tight with cash and had to manage PR internally and put a lot of personal work into it. Funnily enough, I would get twice the coverage. Plus, any work you do is free. Again, sort of. It stands to reason that you know the industry and already know the players, magazines, onlines and bloggers, and it's just a matter of keeping those relationships alive, particularly if they are relationships you've built yourself over the years, so they would think of you and your brand every time they write something relevant. If you think the personal touch would be better than a blanket PR press release to certain people, then you should do it. I can't say after working both with agencies and in-house that one is necessarily better than the other, as both options have their own challenges. If you have the time and the energy to develop those relationships, go for it and do it alone. But if PR is an afterthought and you wouldn't enjoy meeting and chasing journalists, then my advice is get a good PR agency to do the work for you. The press are very spoilt for choice. They receive press releases on hundreds of new products per day and get calls from PRs about the latest, hottest new products. You need to have something new to talk about to the press all the time. You could be launching a new product every 3 months, like most beauty and fashion brands have to do now, or you can pitch about a trend related to your product. It's like finding a way to reinvent your product, giving it another spin. It could be a new use, a seasonal use, or a new celebrity association. It used to be that a product mentioned in Vogue magazine would get you tons of buzz and excitement and lots of sales. Of course, that hasn't completely changed. It's always exciting to see our products featured or recommended in the pages of a prestigious fashion or beauty magazine, and it's still a huge boost for any brand. Contrary to popular myth, the traditional print media isn't dead just yet. But it's even more important for your products to appear on social media. And when it comes to fashion and beauty, especially on Instagram. Bloggers and Instagrammers are creating trends and waiting lists, more so than the magazines. And let's not forget the vloggers and the YouTubers, a whole new industry and a way of communicating with your end consumer that is direct and very real. Another way to generate publicity is to work with the face of the brand. In the first years of building my business, I could barely afford to pay my staff salaries, let alone pay for a face of the brand. But as you grow, there will be people out there who can bring some excitement into your brand without the need of huge amounts of investment. They don't need to be Hollywood stars, but people within your market who have a high profile and could align with your brand. Even though the landscape has changed, similar principles apply now as they did when I started the business. You put together an exciting press release about your product and start sending it to magazines. Now you may ask yourself, why would they choose to feature your product as opposed to the competition? You need to grab their attention. The press release needs to be catchy, and the way you package and send the product needs to look beautiful and represent your brand. A handwritten note by the founder always helps. If you have a product that is different to the competition, you package it well and send it to the right people, it will be featured sooner rather than later. After sending it, you need to follow up, but know your limits. No one likes a stalker. After a while of careful, non-stalking communication, you'll begin to develop personal relationships with your top journalists. Believe it or not, they are all people like you and will happily feature the brand or product of someone they like. But don't be fake. You must be really interested in them and be open and friendly, but not pushy. It takes a while to build trust, and you need to be genuine. You won't get along with everybody, that's just life. But be pleasant to them all the same. It's a bit like a big family wedding. There are always a few in-laws you can't stand, but you want things to go smoothly, so just smile and nod. Smile and nod. Most of all, be yourself, and you'll find that there are journalists and bloggers out there who you get along with like best buddies. These are the relationships you should cherish. The ultimate influencers that can help you create buzz are celebrities, of course. In a world that is dominated by the big brands who offer multi-million dollar contracts to celebrities, how do you get your products in their hands and, better still, get them talking about it? Try to think about celebrities as normal people like you and me. Are you using products from just one brand in any area of your life? Don't you like to discover new and innovative products? It's the same with celebrities. Even the ones with contracts with the big brands still like to discover and try new products. Many celebrities are locked into deals, it's true, but they may only have a contract with a hair brand. So if your product fits in a different category, then there won't be a conflict for them, and they may mention it in the press or on social media. Quite often when celebrities are interviewed, they're asked by the publication to only mention a couple of products from the brand they endorse, and the rest need to be from other brands, otherwise it starts to look less like an interview and more like an infomercial. If they use your products and they like them, you may get lucky, and next time they give a press interview, they may mention them. I know there's a lot of may and lucky in there, but remember, this is free advertising by a celebrity, which would cost you tens of thousands any other way. So if you only get one mention from sending out 100 freebies, then that is a solid win. Sometimes when posting on my @MrsRodial account or uploading to Instagram, it's easy to forget just how new all of this technology is. It has become part of everyday life so quickly that it really boggles me to think of a time, only 5 years ago, when we didn't have it. When I started the business, it was a completely different world, and working with an influencer was a very different process. Back in those ancient before Instagram times, the influencers were traditional celebrities. As a small company with limited, i.e. zero, advertising budget, we would identify a celeb we thought went well with the brand, then send freebie products and goodie bags to their agent or publicist. We would then follow up by bombarding them with calls and emails to find out if the celeb in question had tried, liked, loved our product. And if they had, try to get an official quote. But that was only half the battle. If we did get a quote, then phase two began, trying to convince fashion editors of various magazines and papers that it was worth printing. The bigger the name, the more likely we'd get some column inches. Such and such says, "Rodial changed my life," or "All my Hollywood pals are getting Rodial for Christmas this year," etc. If we got the quote in a magazine, then this hopefully would generate a lot of interest in the brand, and sometimes sales too. As the business gets more mature, you need to reinvent the brand, just like Madonna, and find ways to make your brand and products still relevant against the new brands cropping up everywhere. One way to do this is to host an event. It gives the press interesting content to cover. It does take more work, and it's a bigger investment than a cup of coffee with a journalist, but it's worth it. Do it at a time when not much is happening in the social diary of your town. Everyone likes an invite, and you'd get both press and social media coverage, especially if it's something as big as an award show. Overnight success, secret number 7. Push your creative limits. Are you pushing yourself and your business as far as you can? Sometimes pushing the limits means creating opportunities that other people don't see. If you look at the next 5 years, what are the things that you would like to achieve? Create the opportunities that will take you there in the next 5 years to ensure your business is at the forefront of innovation. No matter how far you go with your current product or idea, you need to push the limits to keep your business fresh and current and relevant. You need to do everything it takes. It's not about beating competition. It's about becoming better than yourself. It's about pushing your limits every single day. There are times when we're all stuck in a situation and we feel there's nothing more we can offer. In business, you have to keep going. How do you get to push your limits every single day? My 10 tips to stay inspired and push your creativity. 1. It takes a lot of self-motivation to push your limits. Find a way to motivate yourself. 2. Browse on YouTube to find interviews with people you admire and watch them. 3. Change location. If you find yourself stuck to your desk and doing the same thing again and again, you need to change your energy. Visit a gallery or go to a place you've never been. 4. Cut pages from magazines of inspirational interviews with people you admire and read them when you're feeling down. 5. Keep emails or notes thanking or praising you for something to read to boost your motivation. 6. Go to a bookstore and browse biographies, business books, and inspirational stories. 7. Pick up the phone and speak to a friend for a light chat and the gossip. 8. Take time to spring clean your office or your wardrobe. It can be very cathartic and also clears your mind ready for new goals. 9. Go for a run or walk in the park. Clear your head and new ideas will come flowing. 10. Have an espresso. It helps. No wonder it's called liquid ambition. Chapter 8. Awards, glamour and celebrities. Early in 2010, we wanted to celebrate 10 years of Rodeal and decided to do something different instead of another boring cocktail party. I thought, wouldn't it be fun to organize an awards event to celebrate all the women we love and have supported us over the years? I got very excited with the idea. I've been a fan and follower of all kinds of award shows over the years, from the Oscars to the Glamour Woman of the Year and everything in between. However, the execution of an awards event for a tiny little beauty company sounded really huge, and I honestly didn't believe we were at the level where we could pull it off. My PR team was pushing for the idea and left it open. They were willing to explore next steps and see where they would lead. Well, I didn't put up too much of a fight because in the few weeks following that meeting, we put together our very first Rodeal Beautiful Awards Show, held in the billiard room at London's Sanderson Hotel. It was small but stylish, like the brand. So it was not quite on the scale of the Oscars or the Golden Globes, but we got a good deal for the space and got drinks included, which was a bonus as we couldn't afford much at the time. We put a panel of judges together, mostly a combination of our friends, and sent them a list of nominees to pick from, and before I knew it, I was stood on stage and handing them out to the likes of Jay Jagger and Paloma Faith. That first year, the awards ran very smoothly. Nobody fell up the steps or sent an Apache Native American as a political protest or got Idina Menzel's name wrong. It was a great night, but more importantly, the awards gave great visibility to Rodeal. We got tons of press coverage, the right associations with celebrities and lots of content for PR and social media. How did we secure the talent to attend the awards? Well, it worked like this. There were 5 categories of celebrities, VIPs. The panel, the presenters, the nominees and winners, and the VIP guests. The starting point was our judging panel, who, as I mentioned, were mostly friends of the brand. By getting them involved in the judging, they felt like they had a bit of ownership of the awards themselves, so we could rely on them to attend, and most were happy to also present an award. To secure the rest was a combination of calling in favours on personal relationships with celebs, and if that didn't work, calling their agents. Dealing with agents is a delicate game, and the key is finding a way to compromise. Generally, the equation goes something like this. We would call agent A and say we wanted to invite, give an award to celebrity X, an A-list celebrity. Agent A would counter by suggesting celebrities Y and Z, B or C list, in order to secure celebrity X or instead of celebrity X. We would then call Agent B and say, "Hey, Agent A is sending Celebrity X, Y, and Z. I hear Celebrity X is good friends with your client, Celebrity D, also A-list. Would you like to present Celebrity X with their award? Yes, they will be on the top table. Yes, they will get a VIP goodie